listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Let's talk about Nicaragua this week, but I think if you do it in context with the other things that are going on in the region, it'll make more sense to folks. That, you know, we haven't really had to cover much in Nicaragua on an ongoing basis other than, you know, so-called good news, development, canals, things like this. And then all of a sudden, the last couple of weeks, an all-out assault by the right wing and the CIA, you can bet, trying to do a regime change operation there, big time.
Yeah, and perhaps you can help me along the way if I get stuck, Don. Because the overall context is very, very clear. And over the last, what is it now, three, four years, really ever since 2015 when in Brazil they started the soft coup against Dilma Rousseff, the then president of Brazil, when Mauricio Macri won the elections in Argentina on completely false promises, which we can see now, completely breaking down.
Right.
In terms of Argentina's prosperity and the well-being of its ordinary people in Argentina.
Right.
And even Bloomberg, I think, published a headline saying something along the lines of international stock markets shocked when Argentina raises its interest rates to 40%. And so, you know, and this is what we were talking about. We've been talking about this for years, ever since that election back in 2015.
Right. We were saying it was how long was it going to take before the people were in the streets? And they've pretty much been in the streets since December of 2015, but it's building now. You can see it's going to that's going somewhere.
Yeah, and even Sergio Massa, the kind of complete, the classic Social Democrat sellout in Argentina, who opened the door for Macri by dividing the opposition vote against Macri. And if Sergio Massa had said to his supporters, well, vote for Cristina, the candidate for Cristina's party, the Frente por Victoria, they'd have won. And Macri would have lost by a mile. But Sergio Massa did the classic Social Democrat thing, held the door open for the right, Macri got in, and now the Social Democrats in Argentina are scrambling to try and cover up what they've done.
Right.
But anyway, and that's another story. It's more important now to talk about the overall context. And so what we've got is this overall context, and its current expressions are things like the imprisonment of Lula da Silva on completely spurious charges of corruption without a scintilla of evidence. Similar events progressing in Ecuador against, or that have progressed against the former vice president, Jorge Glass, and now the authorities there with the complacent collaboration of President Lenin Moreno. They're trying to prepare a case also completely spurious against Rafael Correa. Mm-hmm. In Colombia, you've got this outrageous case of the prosecution of Jesus Sandrich, a key figure who made the peace process possible in Colombia, who now, in complete contravention of almost every single agreement of the components that make up the Colombian peace process, he now risks being extradited to the United States on the basis of zero evidence again.
Right. Yep.
So you have that whole process going on. You also have the process going on in Venezuela of attempts by the United States government and their regional allies to call into question the validity of the Venezuelan elections, but so far at least the opposition candidate Henry Falcón, who's likely to do very well, although he may not win against the incumbent president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, he's likely to do quite well. He is resisting calls by the US-dominated extreme right opposition, the Popular Will parties and the Justice First parties, to boycott the elections, and that it looks as though they're in Venezuela. We saw last year that people in Venezuela are less and less inclined to follow the completely discredited policies of the extreme right wing in Venezuela. And this will be relevant for our subsequent conversation about Nicaragua, Don.
Right.
But anyway, as a result of what's going on in Venezuela, the local allies of the United States, Brazil, Chile, currently under Brazil's government under the current usurper president Michel Temer, and Chile under its new right-wing president Sebastián Piñera,
right,
again as a result of a divided left-wing vote. In Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, who's and we know very well what Juan Manuel Santos is, kind of complete creature of the United States.
Yep.
In Paraguay, very shady elections overshadowed by serious allegations of corruption. A new right-wing president to succeed Horacio Cartes has taken power.
Yeah.
Somebody with links to the previous Stroessner dictatorship.
Yeah, I mean, this is a successor to a successor of another coup, by the way, the soft coup in Paraguay, right?
Right. So, but against that, you have what we've been talking about for a long time as well, for years as well, the fact that even these right-wing governments recognize the United States as an economic power in decline, and they're protecting their interests by hedging their bets, making new agreements with China. And so what you have there is over on the Pacific coast of South America, you have Peru working very closely with one of the leading ALBA governments, the progressive bloc. ALBA is the progressive bloc made up of Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Bolivia, previously Ecuador. It's questionable if Ecuador will continue in ALBA, and some Caribbean island nations. But the fact that Bolivia is one of those progressive countries has just over the last week or so signed a very important agreement about to do with customs regulations and trade regulations between the two countries, facilitating the intercontinental railroad, which is going to be funded by China to the tune of billions and billions of dollars, and involves investment from even Western corporate capitalist interests, from especially from Western Europe, but so far as I know, none from the United States, which is also very telling, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that process of the kind of, and I don't like using this word, but I'm kind of, if you like, the split personality, the schizophrenic kind of feelings of the South American elite in particular towards the United States, and, well, what are we going to do because the United States is going to fall through the cracks in the next few years, and we have to protect our interests, and so that means we need to strike a deal with the Chinese and with the rest of Asia, for example, South Korea, Thailand, Taiwan, all these countries, and the Indonesia in particular, of course, which is a tremendous, it's one of the biggest powers in the Southeast Asia organization, ASEAN. So anyway, and all that's going on, and so that dynamic is in conflict with the dynamic of increasing U.S. insistence on trying to recuperate its neocolonial dominance in South America, Central America, and the Caribbean. And so that's the overall context of what's going on here in Nicaragua.
Well, you have this also, I mean, a piece at Telesur that you wrote, for example, mentions that, you know, Gbagbo and Gaddafi in Libya. So, you know, the U.S. started recapturing, lost colonies or whatever during the Obama years in Africa also. And then there's been, of course, the affirmative moves across the Middle East, moving down the list of parties that included Syria and the pushback in Bahrain against the popular uprising there and yada, yada, yada. And even forward activity into Ukraine. So this is, the home turf here. You're seeing that phenomenon play out here as well. It's already been asserted around the globe pretty much.
Yeah, very much so. And you can, and what's happening in Nicaragua is very much a reflection of all that. And just by accident, I've been interested in what's been happening on in Western and North Africa. And what's happening in Latin America is very similar to that. And what's happening in Western North Africa? The European Union, through its one of its two most important members, forget about the United Kingdom, its two most important members are Germany and France. And so, within Europe, Germany is the dominant power. But what is France's contribution to the European Union? Colonies. France's contribution to the European Union is its control over its, and also to a lesser extent the United Kingdom, but more importantly France, is its control over its former colonial territories,
right,
which comprise most of Western North Africa. That is the main, and apart from its own internal economy and that's contribution to the European Union. And among the great hypocrisies of the European Union and the apologists for the European Union is their failure to recognize how France's the French neocolonial domination of Africa contributes to the overall global political power projected by the European Union.
Right.
It's tremendous hypocrisy. And what the French have done, why is Mali still one of the poorest countries in the world? And because it's a former French neo-colonial territory, and it remains under French neocolonial control,
right,
especially after the attack against Libya. And that was one of the reasons for the attack against Libya, as you and I and many people have been arguing for ever since the NATO intervention against Libya. One of the main reasons that they intervened against Libya was because Libya was preventing or impeding the continued neo-colonial domination of West Africa and North Africa.
That's right.
And you can see that very closely, very clearly. So that the same phenomenon is happening now in Latin America. You have the former colonial power, the United States, the former imperialist power, imposing its policies on the rest of the region through its local elites. And so where are the countries where there's resistance to that? Any country that resists that is going to be a target for intervention of one kind or another.
Right.
So we see that in Cuba with the intensification of sanctions that had been superficially relaxed under President Obama, but in an attempt to use a different modality, and now Trump and his administration have returned to the previous set of policies that Obama correctly identified as having completely failed. Why they think they're going to work again in this current context, and only they can kind of hallucinate, you know. And so the one fundamental thing from the international scene that we should apply to the role of the United States here in Latin America is that they are non-agreement capable. And nothing that people agree with the United States is worth the paper it's written on.
Right.
We can see that in what's happening vis-a-vis Iran. We can see that vis-a-vis the serial breaches of confidence by the United States in its relations with Russia. We know very well that the reason North Korea and South Korea are reaching a rapprochement is that China and Russia have intervened to try and promote denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. It's got nothing to do with the threats made by President Trump against the government and people of North Korea. And so, and all that stuff that we've been talking about over the previous 10, 15 minutes, and we need to use that as context to understand what's going on in Nicaragua. And one of the things that I find really quite depressing about any media coverage of what's been going on in Nicaragua is the level of ignorance, of historical ignorance, about this country and the Central American region in general. So what's the current situation in Nicaragua? Okay, yeah. So from April 19th to April 23rd, yeah. there were serious internal disturbances involving essentially cannon fodder, students being used as cannon fodder by the right-wing groups that are supported by the United States. And even now, minor disturbances continue, mainly promoted by paid delinquents, and who during that period of April 19th to April 23rd, it's very well established now that they were being paid by the political organizers of that of those disturbances, and $10 to $15 a day.
Right.
And so what you see here on the news is constant denunciations by ordinary people in the barrios affected, in the urban districts affected, especially in Managua, where the main disturbances are centered, of gang activity, whereby gang members who have tried to associate themselves with the student protests, but who in fact have nothing to do with the student protests, and they're charging people, motorcyclists and motorists, they're taking money from them to allow them to pass through their barricades in these areas. Now, for the moment, the Nicaraguan police haven't taken action about that. But I have the feeling, I might be completely wrong about this, but my feeling is that the authorities are letting that happen for the moment, partly because they're stretched very thin in terms of their police resources trying to provide security across Managua, which is a very sprawling urban area.
Right.
And nor do they want to give the political opposition a pretext for saying, oh, more government repression.
Yeah, you know, that's something that I noticed in the Soviet Union and also in Libya when I visited those places. And that is, for some reason, in all these police states, you can never find a cop when you need one. You know, you walk around New York City, you got five in your back pocket carrying machine guns and stuff. But this isn't the police state. In Libya, where, you know, you can't cross the street on the shore road because there's no police. There's like, you know, two cops for all of Libya or whatever. That's a police state. The United States is something else. So it's the same thing. Let me just recap this a bit. I mean, you had between the 19th and the 23rd thereabouts of April, this just passed, all of a sudden, simultaneously, riots sprung up with students making demands around the same basically, there was two pieces of legislation that dealt with pensions. Not exactly what students generally preoccupy themselves with, which is something on the other end of their careers, but about pensions, that there were Molotov cocktail kits available across the country, basically, in each of these uprisings, or whatever you want to call them, basically each of these riots, which happened in a coordinate way over a three-day period. While that happens, you start seeing these other steps come in. In other words, it's a playbook that somebody was running, and somebody had clearly organized.
Yeah, and so we go back to the Maidan in Kiev. We go back to the events in Caracas in 2002, in both cases, and also in Syria and Daraa, or Libya and Benghazi, back in 2011. In all those cases, people were there were deaths that were attributed to the government, but in the context of very, very serious public order disturbances. And if you look at how does the United States deal with public order disturbances, you know, and do they send their police out offering people kind of flowers? It's just the level of hypocrisy involved is tremendous. But the fundamental thing here is that the government immediately, rather than as what happened in Libya and Syria, in particular, and perhaps to some extent in the Ukraine, rather than kind of doubling down on efforts to defend public order, they simply said, "All right, well, we'll withdraw the issue, the pension reform that was which is supposedly the issue that triggered these riots,
right,
and these protests, and we're open for dialogue. So let's talk."
Right.
And so that's where Nicaragua is now. So you had this intense period of severe public order disturbances in which people were killed. And I've seen estimates of 45 or 60 or up to 100 people killed. But the really solid information that we have is that around 23 people were killed. And certainly, it's likely or probable that the final death toll will be set somewhat higher. Right. But what we're finding and what has been coming to light over the last few days is that, for example, I know of at least three cases, perhaps four, three cases in which people who are figure in death lists put about by the opposition human rights organizations here, funded by the NATO countries of the European Union.
Right.
Three of those people have appeared on Facebook saying, "We're not dead. We don't understand why we're appearing in these death lists, and this is extremely upsetting for our families, so please stop it."
Right.
We had another family over the last week whose son died of a heart attack, completely unrelated to the student protests, and he too appeared in the list of protesters killed by the police. And so you have this kind of persistent, consistent disinformation appearing in the social networks that subsequently gets revealed to be completely untrue. But by, and it's like that old saying, what's that saying? A lie is halfway around the world while the truth is still pulling on its pants.
Yeah.
You know, and so it doesn't matter. I mean, the fact that untruth is proved to be untrue, it's already had its impact on public opinion and on general opinion. And so, and what we're likely to find is that while the final death toll as a result of these disturbances on both sides, I mean, police officers killed, a Sandinista activist killed, innocent, but I know of at least one person killed here in Esteli, who was a guy from the rural town of Palacaguina, and he was just caught up in as a bystander in the events of the Friday night that week, and he was killed. He had nothing to do with the protests. So you have bystanders, Sandinista activists, police, and you also have protesters that have been killed. And so it's completely unrealistic and false of the international corporate media, almost all alternative media in the Western world, to project an image that, you know, it was just blanket government repression and all the people dead were protesters. That's completely untrue.
Here's part of the problem, too, by the way. I don't think people have a full appreciation of this, but I remember experiencing this back in 2011 from, you know, inside the box. Like, you know, you see the effectiveness of certain foreign media that's produced in the English language in providing some, you know, missing elements of the narrative, like the true part. And, you know, with RT and Sputnik and CGTN and Telesur and, you know, Press TV and on, that one starts to mistakenly, I don't know, lose sight of how much power is behind Western propaganda, which, the aggregate of Western media outlets has somebody on the ground on just about every square inch of the planet, and many of the people that they're with, or they're embedded with, are actors in a lot of these things. And so, you know, that's not the case for, say, Press TV or RT, as, you know, as well-rounded as their staffs might be. You know, they're not the global hegemon. And so for somebody to try to figure out in Moscow or Mexico City, or, you know, wherever their bureaus are, what's happening in some village in Nicaragua inside the news cycle, without reference to what the New York Times published or whatever, there's a curve, you know, that takes a while to get up to speed. And so I saw this. I remember scratching my head for 2 or 3 weeks dealing with Press TV and RT when the attacks on NATO, on Libya, started by NATO, thinking to myself, what the hell are these people thinking? Are they insane? Yeah. Because I knew what was going on, because I was talking to people there that I knew, and I had been there recently, and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's just not the case for every one of these organizations regarding every spot on the planet. It's just, there's a learning curve.
Yeah, which is another aspect of the power of Western media, right?
Exactly.
So anyway, why would the United States want to upset and disturb and overthrow the current government in Nicaragua? Well, because it's resisting the United States regional policy,
right? They
which
don't
is
know
one that. Of just destruction of the nation state,
right?
In the regions and subordination of sovereign nation states to the influence, especially a U.S. corporate influence, of course, but also to facilitate U.S. corporate influence, to the influence of U.S. institutions. So you have, in the case of El Salvador and Guatemala in particular, you have a case where the attorney generals of something like 4 or 5 United States states, you know, that compose the country of the United States, they are the ones that are calling the shots in terms of internal corruption anti-crime investigations in those countries.
I know. Look at the big picture stuff. You've got this attack takes place on Nicaragua while all of the other battles have been going on in Venezuela, in Brazil, and across the region. And now this push comes with the push. They start dismantling some of the architecture of unity and solidarity that's been assembled in the last 20 years. For example, UNASUR. Like one of the biggest achievements, a regional, self-directed group of the states in the Western Hemisphere, excluding the United States and Canada, and now it's broken in half. Broken in half. Yeah, who would have thought that possible a year ago?
Yeah, and of course that leads to a resurgence of the Organization of American States, which is completely under the thumb of the U.S. State Department and the U.S. government.
Which was the point of doing it in the first place. There were centers of power that had developed and coalesced, beginning in earnest with the with Chavez and the experiment that he set in motion in 1999 and onward, at have been public enemy number one for the United States ever since. They jumped in early on with the coup in 2002, and woe to those who undertook that project. The people themselves turned it around in 48 hours. This must have been the most frightening thing that they'd witnessed in this hemisphere since the Haitian Revolution in 1802 or 1804 or whatever. And so they have been furiously tracking this project ever since. Even as China has been designing canals and transcontinental railroads in conjunction with the people of the region for the next 100 years worth of economic activity. And that's this whole thing, we're seeing in earnest the United States go into battle to try to regain its territories. And we're going to see, I guess, as it plays out, whether or not that happens. And we got to stop here because we're out of time, Tony.
Oh, I'm sorry, Don, because there are a couple of things, important things to say about Nicaragua. But never mind, maybe next week.
Yeah, we'll pick it up later this week, I think, because we have a lot to cover that we haven't touched yet. So thank you very much for your time, as always. And
you're very welcome, Don. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks. Take care.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. As Russia's relations with the West are put to test, Vladimir Putin is taking the presidential office for the fourth time. What is a Russian leader like? Well, I ask Hubert Seipel, German journalist who gave his view of the Russian president in the documentary film I, Putin. Hubert Seipel, welcome to the show. It's great to have you with us. I haven't seen you in a while, so we're finally doing this little chat, and I'm glad we get to do this. So you've had unprecedented access to Vladimir Putin. He personally came to an event about your book on him, and you had face-to-face time with him during the shooting of your film about him. He calls you personally on the phone, and you answer, Hubert. I wonder why you... I mean, you may know more about our president than maybe we do, because he's a very private person. Why does he trust you?
You know, look at me. You understand that perfectly, actually. No,
right. Who wouldn't trust you?
I think it's a matter of time, and it's a matter of time, because we went quite some months together for the film, so I interviewed him a couple of years, more or less, within 3 months' distance about for the book. So you get to know each other a little bit, and you know how or whom you can trust to a certain extent. And that's, I think, the basis why we have this kind of relation.
So while filming your documentary, I, Putin, back in 2012, you had the chance to see Vladimir Putin in different settings. What was your personal opinion of him, and what kind of vibes did you pick up? Usually, public figures of his scale are one person off the screen and then another person on the screen. Do you feel he was genuine? Did you sense like a public persona for the cameras being displayed for you?
You know, politician is a profession, and you act like a professional, of course. But you have, to a certain extent, an identity. And if you want to convince, you cannot really cut your identity you have normally from the profession you perform. So I think to a certain extent he's genuine, but he's a tactician too, of course. And he is an actor as well, because this business requires acting, because you deal with journalists and journalists act as well. So we have both a profession and we act, so to speak, along the profession. But the longer you speak to each other, the more you understand the way he acts and the way he argues and the way he is. And that's it.
So, I mean, I come from a family of a former president as well, and I understand how these things work. Like, when you're a leader, you have to be tough. There's no room for emotions. Like, your personal emotions don't really matter when you're, you know, handling global affairs. You said that Putin came across as very alive. What kind of emotions did you get out of him during your conversations?
He's an emotional guy. So it is not very hard to play on the emotion. But on the other hand, he's a tactician too, and he knows exactly what he wants to transform or what he wants to bring over. So journalists and politicians have a role, and they play along this role. And of course, they have a common currency. The common currency is the public. And so they behave to reach this aim, to get their messages through. And that's a kind of game on one side. And on the other side, it is quite serious, because people rely and they trust what they get, so to speak, what they see and what they hear. So both parties have to develop this kind of art and to stick to their profession. And I think, all in all, Putin lives by two things: by his emotion, and he is in the long, he plays a very long game. He's, so to speak, a long distance runner in politics, and that's the way they underestimate him. I give you one little example why Putin obviously had been underestimated for such a long time. In the beginning of my research, I found a memo by a big bank. It was in the memo was from the year 2000 when he took over office. And the analysts try to inform their board of directors what kind of guy this guy is and what to expect. And they simply said at that time, Vladimir Vladimirovich is someone who got orders for the last 10 years, and he is very happy to be in this position, and he follows these orders. And this kind of, so to speak, underestimating this guy took place first in the beginning in Russia, and then it took place, of course, in the West.
You mean the misperception of him as someone who would follow someone else's orders? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's one of the things. And the second thing that you always have been warned of is, you know, this guy is a former KGB guy. He knows how to deal with people. Definitely, it's true. He worked once for this agency, and definitely he knows how to treat people. But that's only one part of it. He's a very direct guy. And if you respond to this directness, you get results.
But, I mean, direct is one thing, but do you feel like everything he tells you is the truth? Or he can't allow himself to say the truth?
No politician in this world, come on, no politician in this world tells you 100% of the truth. It's a tactical appearance to a certain extent. It's public, and you want to transport something via public. But that's what the business requires. But at the same time, if you do lie, and if you do lie too often, you're not to be trusted. And look to the figures, basically, from 2000 up to today. So I think the figure, he had been elected with the percentage, I think 53%. And if you go 12 years later, when he returned from the prime ministry job, he got, I think, 64%. And now he's somewhere at nearly 77%. So you have a steady growth, and you cannot reach this in just lying to the population and lying to Russia, so to speak.
So when describing his persona, you mentioned the fact that he had a KGB background, and Western media, as well as the establishment, often put some special focus on Putin's past as an intelligence officer. I mean, we all come from different backgrounds. What is so special about that? George Bush Sr. was CIA head before he became U.S. president. Nobody saw this as a problem.
No, it is not a real problem because it's a demonization, basically, what it is. Our former foreign minister, Klaus Kinkel, was 2 years head of the BND. So that you can use it as a kind of picture, as a kind of threat from the past, because we're all living on prejudices. And if you develop these prejudices, you can demonize somebody. You know, politics is theater, it's drama, and the difference between and interests and, so to speak, PR is very, very big occasionally. But it was always the case this way. And so as far as Putin was concerned, they used these three words. And I think this is nothing else, because it's just a way to say, okay, this guy is lying, he cannot do anything different, you don't trust him. But it's a PR weapon, nothing more.
So I want to go back to your film. I know that there was a scene where Putin took you to a chapel and he talked to you about his faith. Why did you leave that scene out of the film?
I found it at the very moment too personal. So, and I had more material than I needed. So I had to think what to use and what not to use. And I found that in the very moment, okay, it's very private. It is very, so to speak, vulnerable to a certain extent. So I left it out at the moment because I found other things more important in that context. That's the reason for that.
Well, because he rarely opens up to anyone like that. I mean, if he spoke to you about his faith and he actually, you know, allowed you to be there while speaking about it, and he knew it was going to be on film, it's weird that you would leave it out. This is the journalist talking in me. And you actually got a lot other moments where he was very vulnerable, not only the one in a chapel. And that's a very rare side of Putin as well. You filmed the Russian president in a lot of situations, during short vacation, during hockey practice. How did you get him used to your cameras and just to be himself? Or did he never really forget about the cameras?
I'm not quite sure about that, but he never gave any kind of direction. We were just there, we were just watching, and I didn't get any kind of direction to do this or to do that. So I think he got accustomed after a certain time that we are present, and it worked that way. And I'm not a very hostile person a very hostile journalist. I watch and I try to understand and I have questions. So I'm not in a constant fighting position, because my philosophy is very simple. I think people, first of all, have an understanding of what they are seeing and can judge by themselves. So I don't have really to press for any kind of infight or to present myself as a very critical guy. I am critical, but I just simply ask questions and I leave my viewers to decide whether this was okay, whether this was bad, whether this was a lie or normal. So this is a tendency as far as my work is concerned. And secondly, if you are not all the time saying behave this way, behave that way, it looks better this way or that way, it works easier. It works much, much better.
So, I mean, this film really opens up Putin's personality in the way that you see him in situations, and nothing extraordinary, just random situations that a human being would find himself in. It's just that we've never seen Putin like that before, like hunting, practicing hockey, swimming, or like hugging his dog. Why do you think your country and the Western audience in general needed to see this side of him?
Because we have stereotypes. You know, we mentioned this KGB thing beforehand. And so it is an incarnation of the evil. And the longer PR stresses facts like that, the more the more they become, so to speak, real. So we fictionize reality to a certain extent by repetition. And I thought, okay, this guy is a human being, as you and me. He's a politician. He was at the right time, at the right place, and he tries to develop something for his country. Okay, and going away from this kind of trenches, ideological trenches, my interest was, how does he argue? How does he behave? And what are his interests? Because it's all about interests of a country a president normally represents. And so it was much more important than to build up another picture of an enemy, which is useless because it's a repetition. And the world is different than that.
Okay, Hubert, we're going to take a short break right now. And when we're back, we'll continue talking to Hubert Zeipel, German journalist and documentary filmmaker, about how the world sees the Russian president. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
We're back with Hubert Zeipel, German journalist and author of the documentary film I, Putin, discussing what Vladimir Putin is like in the eyes of the world. So in your movie, you highlight the beginning of Putin's first term, his visit to Bundestag, where he talked about Russia not being an equal partner in the West. 18 years later, and we're still not partners. Why do you think nothing changes in this regard?
Yeah, it's a good question. You mean I can finally answer it? But I will start. You remember before he spoke in the Bundestag, I think 2-3 months before, the first time he met George Bush. And there was this meeting, and I think George Bush said basically, I looked in the eyes, in his eyes, I got a sense of his soul. You remember that?
I remember. And I remember McCain said too.
Yeah, McCain said, I looked in his eye and I saw three letters, KGB, if I remember this correctly. But Bush at the same time added at the same time, he's honest, he's direct, and he has a great interest for his country. So 3 months later, or 2 months later, I think it was in the Deutsche Bundestag, it was an interesting talk, but the main point he said there, okay, he said, we are talking, we want to get to come together, but at the same time, we distrust each other. And we are hiding and we're trying to play games. And I think from the very beginning onward, from 2000 onward up till to date, there is this distrust about intention. And at the other hand, there is obviously the coalition of interests. And interests are the main point in the whole fight here. I think up till 2008, more or less, we were trying to get along. Then we had 2008, Georgian War, and then we had the Ukraine as well. It was always on one side the fight for democracy and freedom, and on the other side, the evil reconstruction of the Soviet Union. But it was at the same time, of course, interest. The history, the politics of a country is basically formed by the history of a country, by geopolitical interests, by economic interests, by current events. But you have to take this into account. And Russia had this, and the West had that. It was very complicated. It was a misunderstanding from the very beginning, I think. There was no agreement after the collapse of the Soviet Union. When was it? In December 1991, that Russia would be now become another part of the West. It didn't work out. There are interests, and I think the West miscalculated this interest and played their own interests only. And Russia, of course, did try to get through with its interest, and Putin was the one who was underestimated, but he pushed it through.
During this latest scandal around the Skripal poisoning, Theresa May, for instance, presented Russia with an ultimatum. And that's not like the first time West speaks to Russia like that. Moscow's reply has always been, you know, don't talk to us like this. You know, don't tell us what to do. This keeps repeating in Russia-West relations, this problem of condescending lecturing and, you know, moralistic tone. Why?
Why is a good question. I think it's depending on the moment you are in the very moment. And I think this is simply political agitation.
But it's not about the tone. It's about the methods. I mean, you see the Arab countries like India or China are always, you know, a lot more neutral in the way they communicate. Have you noticed that? always very careful with words. Why? Why do you think the Western politicians are so prone to public scolding of others, to, you know, to teacher-like behavior?
I think we watched Russia to a certain extent as a kind of, you know, handicapped school children who hardly reach, so to speak, the level to become adults. I think that was an early attitude in the 90s, and to a certain extent, it is still an attitude, and on the other side, it's a political weapon. We still forget that Russia is grown up. They are not under 18 anymore. But at the same time, as we argued in the 90s, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to, and if you do that, it will work. This attitude never changed, because we consider us as having won the Cold War, and that gives us a kind of moral superiority. And on the other hand, the response of Russia is quite direct too. So you have a national pride at the same time, which tells you, go to hell.
Do you think the West has come to grips with the fact that Russia's not irrelevant anymore, like it was after the Soviet Union collapsed?
They have to, because we have now a multipolar world and not so much a unipolar world anymore. It doesn't matter to whom you are talking to. If you talk to Angela Merkel, she will tell you, with some hesitation nevertheless, but she will tell you, we have to talk with Russia, because Russia is an important player, and without Russia you don't get an agreement in Syria. But in the meantime, we have so many different players at the same time that neither America nor Russia can guarantee a final solution. But the condition is they have to talk to each other to get a final solution, to convince the others around them to help them. You have Iran, you have Turkey, you have Saudi Arabia. You have a number of players in the meantime. And that makes the situation so dangerous, because you never know when the escalation, so to speak, reached its final point, and something is happening, and probably it's an escalation you don't want, but you get. If you look back to Syria at the very moment, we had an escalation of words, but at the very end, you have, in the meantime, what a number of destroyed buildings, no Russian had been hurt, and probably now is the chance to talk. I think it's a very good chance in the very moment to find a solution together, because everybody sees it's not working that way.
So Germany is a country that is very close to Russia, and especially with Putin's German past. And that relationship is very important, seeing how it's Germany at the forefront of the European Union. Angela Merkel and Putin also have a relationship that endured through the years. Is this sanction story, the confrontation, going to destroy that relationship completely?
I don't think so. That's destroyed completely. I think both people are rational politicians, and we see in the very moment what I mentioned just before. We have a big chance in the very moment to come to terms, because, you know, we have issues like Nord Stream 2, the gas from Russia to Germany. We have Syria at the same time. We have an unreliable American partner at the same time. So within Europe, we have difficulties, and I think we have to solve some problems only together, and we have to do that. So the situation is quite good, I would say, even if it doesn't look like that. Angela Merkel is going to has been going to Washington. Macron has been going to Washington. If it's true that Putin got an invitation, I don't know yet. But that gives us the chance to lean back, to see what are our interests, and to find a solution. I think it's better than we think. The funny thing in between is us Germans, by the way. The Russian ones and the German ones. There was an interesting research being done just recently that as far as foreign policy is concerned, all the journalists are trying to stick to their governments and increase the trauma, so to speak, on the other side. It's not so much true as far as interior politics is concerned. But obviously, in foreign policy, you have a traumatization by the journalists on both sides as well.
So in your movie, Putin was described as a man whose mind is not easy to change and who doesn't forget insults or double crossings. Do you think this personal trait of his will give way to political consideration? Will he forget the confrontation with the West if a chance is offered to end this confrontation?
You know, you don't have to forget it. But you have, I don't think that he will forget it, but he's a rational person on the other side as well. And he knows exactly how politics works and what is needed if you want to have a long-time solution. Now it's last term. So he has another 6 years to fix things which went wrong to a certain extent. It's not only depending on him, definitely not. But he has this chance. And after such a long time of confrontation on both sides, why shouldn't he use that as his kind of testimony, so to speak? And he is a rational man, so I don't see why he wouldn't do that. The interesting thing is you don't have to take everything personal, what happens in politics. If you do that, then you are lost. And I think he's not lost.
All right, Hubert, thank you very much for this interesting insight and for your thoughts. We were talking to Hubert Seipel, German journalist and author of the documentary film I, Putin, discussing how the world sees the Russian leader and how he affects Russia's relations with the rest of the world. That's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I'll see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.